I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. In trying to understand how we are confronted with the opioid crisis, the worst drug epidemic in U.S. history, it's clear today that pharmaceutical companies, drug distributors, the U.S. Congress, doctors, pharmaceutical companies, and street drug dealers have all played a role. The result is a tragedy that affects families and communities across the country. The CDC estimates that 91 people die from an opioid overdose every day in this country. Last year, 900 people in Philadelphia alone overdosed on opioids. Deaths from prescription opioids, including oxycodone, hydrocodone, and methadone, have quadrupled since 1999. Here's President Trump declaring the opioid epidemic a national emergency and talking about what he learned from his brother Fred, who was an alcoholic.
The fact is, if we can teach young people and people generally not to start, it's really, really easy not to take them. And I think that's going to end up being our most important thing.
Today on Radio Times, we take a look at the root causes of the opioid epidemic, the politics of pain, and where we go from here. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Keith Wailu. He's a professor in the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University, where he's also a professor in the Department of History, and he wrote a book called Pain, A Political History. Keith Wailu, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us from the Washington Post Studios is Lenny Bernstein. He's health and medicine reporter for the Washington Post, co-author of an investigation into how lobbyists for pharmaceutical companies worked with Congress to weaken the DEA's enforcement of opioid abuse. And this was a joint collaboration with 60 Minutes. Lenny Bernstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me just begin. I just feel like we need to pause and just acknowledge the seriousness of this crisis that we're in. Keith, I'm looking at you because you're sitting across from me. I read that something like 9% of people in this country know someone who has died from an opioid overdose. That is just breathtaking.
It is breathtaking. And I think if you look at it over the last 20 years, what's also breathtaking is the way in which the toll has expanded. It expanded by starting in places like West Virginia and Maine, Alaska, and Florida, and gradually, and was characterized as hillbilly heroin in its early days because of its prevalence in particular areas of depressed economies in rural West Virginia, let's say. And it's expanded well beyond those demographic and geographical boundaries. So it's not just the toll in numbers, it's also the toll in deaths. And it's become a national calamity.
And going from some of these rural areas to a city like Philadelphia.
Exactly.
Let me turn to you. And I was talking with Keith about this before going on the air. It does also tell us about just the amount of pain that people are suffering from in this country. About half of Americans have taken a prescription opioid. What does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that there is a lot of pain in this country, but it also tells us that these pills are being prescribed for things that they probably were not meant to be used for. Pardon me. They should not be prescribed for low back pain or knee pain or the sprained ankle that you got on the soccer field. And over the past two decades or so, under a very, very heavy marketing campaign by drug companies, that sort of became commonplace. It also was because doctors wanted to do well on satisfaction surveys that asked people about how their pain was being treated.
Well, let me go to you, Keith, and your book is called The Politics of Pain, or Pain, A Political History. What do you mean by the politics of pain?
Well, on a number of different levels. If you look at the story of OxyContin, and how it has emerged as a problem over the last 20 years, there's a fascinating expanding cast of characters who exist in the sort of policy space that have been named villains. Early on, it was, as I said, bad consumers.
Drug addicts.
Bad actors, yes, addicts, et cetera. And then that expanded to maybe pill mills. And so there were bad physicians. What Leni Bernstein just pointed out is that gradually, within maybe about 5 years or so, it became clear that we have to look at the pharmaceutical industry. But of course, to really challenge the pharmaceutical industry with regard to their marketing practices, their influence on doctors, you're entering a political realm where questions about the free market, questions about how we regulate businesses, how these drugs got onto the market in the first place, are heatedly debated in the halls of Congress. So the question of where the opioid epidemic came from is inherently, yes, it's a question of doctors and patients, but it's also a question of a regulatory system and our political system.
Let me play an advertisement, and this is from – it's actually a promotional video from 1998 from Purdue Pharmaceuticals using this to market OxyContin. Let's give it a listen.
There's no question that our best, strongest pain medicines are the opioids. But these are the same drugs that have a reputation for causing addiction and other terrible things. Now, in fact, the rate of addiction amongst pain patients who are treated by doctors is much less than 1%. They don't wear out, they go on working, they do not have serious medical side effects. And so these drugs, which I repeat, are our best, strongest pain medications, should be used much more than they are for patients in pain.
I mean, Lenny, that sounds like the perfect drug.
You know, they're strong, all right. They also cause euphoria. They also cause addiction, as we now know. But they were marketed in 1998 as the perfect drug. There was use of a very poor early survey of, I believe, 12 patients in a hospital, none or few of whom got addicted, to try to persuade doctors that these things were not addictive. Doctors were under pressure to address pain as the fifth vital sign. And it all came together in this seemingly wonderful solution to a number of problems at the same time. And within a few years, we realized, oh, my gosh, we've done something terrible here.
Well, let me go back to you, Keith. And again, I was talking about this with you before going on the air. And I do remember doing interviews 20, 25 years ago about hospice and end-of-life care. And I can't tell you how many of our guests, very credentialed people, say were saying, we are withholding pain. We are causing unnecessary suffering. We need to be more generous in dealing with people's pain.
Yeah. I mean, without excusing the practices of marketing, it's important to remember the context, which is in the 1990s, there was a question about whether the war on drugs had become excessive, and that is whether our fears about drugs and addiction had really produced all kinds of really egregious, whether incarceration trends or restrictions on access to medicines. And at the same time, we had the physician-assisted suicide laws that were really emerging in places like Oregon, where the question about whether we can provide compassionate care at the end of life is something that we should all get behind. These were being debated in Congress, and they were being debated in state legislatures. And so OxyContin emerges at a time, and in fact, its first most predominant use was in end-of-life care, to say we can provide compassionate care at the end of life without using morphine, which depresses respiration, inhibits respiration and blood pressure, and actually may hasten death. So here's a great way to provide pain relief at the end of life without getting into the tangled issues having to do with physician-assisted suicide. But then it expanded. It expanded well beyond into the realms that Leni Bernstein just mentioned. I want to highlight one other thing about the argument that Purdue Pharma made, which was that oxycodone in the OxyContin formulation was a time-release mechanism so that you actually weren't using – you weren't getting the full dose at once. And this was argued to kind of lead to less likelihood of addiction as well. And to some extent, physicians and policymakers and others bought that argument, as Leni pointed out, because it made sense on a general level. And it was part of a declaration and a commitment to compassionate care.
Was it all marketing, Leni, that it went from end-of-life care to soccer injuries?
Substantially, it was marketing. Of course, those who were abusing these substances figured out very quickly how good a high they could provide. For example, that extended release had a lot of the active ingredient in it, and substance users figured out that it could be crushed or snorted, and then they realized they were getting a heck of a lot more than they would, say, in a regular 5 or 10 milligram oxycodone. So, yes, it was marketing. Yes, it was pressure on doctors to relieve pain in ways that they hadn't before. Yes, it was these drugs spilling out onto the street because companies and pharmacists and doctors were not being careful, and abusers were enjoying pharmaceutical-grade drugs. So at the risk of repeating myself, you had a perfect storm of 3-4 factors coming together that created this crisis.
And the one thing I'd say also is that in the early days, Purdue Pharma and others really promoted this narrative that the real problem with this drug is the people who are crushing and snorting and getting highs. The real problem is diversion. And the policy response needs to be not restricting the drug as doctors use it, because, of course, we also have a system that says, you know, a drug becomes approved for a particular purpose, but doctors may use it off-label for any. And so the question at that time wasn't, are doctors misusing it? The question is, what are these bad actors doing, crushing it, giving the drug effectively a bad name? And so this is actually where you have doctor shopping laws and diversion laws being created to try to mitigate the damage that's being created by something like the marketing.
Is there some parallel between what you just described there and the tobacco industry?
Well, there's a parallel there in the sense that large companies are very shrewd at not just marketing. And the other phenomenon that's here is this is an era when direct-to-consumer marketing is emerging. The idea that, you know, we have a regulatory system that has really stood in between consumers and marketers. We used to, you know, when I was a kid, you didn't have ads on television telling you, go ask the doctor for something. So from the 1980s forward, you had a system that said, you know, the best drugs are the drugs that consumers know about, and they go to their doctor and they say, what about this doc? And the physician feels kind of constrained to answer those needs. And so, like, West Virginia is a really good example of a place where you have an economy that's driven by mining, by logging, by literally backbreaking work. And if somebody wants to go back to work pain-free, OxyContin answered the need. And if you went to your doctor and said, I need something for my back because I don't really want to take time off of work, I want to go back, that's where the OxyContin appeal first manifested itself.
I want to pick up on that. And Lainey, I do want to talk about your investigation into this whole issue. That's Keith Wailu and Lainey Bernstein. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, to join the conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, and I'm talking with Keith Wailu. He's a Princeton University professor. Also with Lainey Bernstein, he's health and medicine reporter for The Washington Post, talking about the roots of the opioid epidemic. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Lainey, let me get to the investigation that you did, and it appeared on 60 Minutes as well. Essentially, that Congress passed a law, this was in 2016, signed by President Obama, that ended up weakening the DEA that was investigating drug companies that were, in a sense, creating the opioid epidemic. What was the law that got changed?
It was called the Controlled Substances Act, and it was passed in 1970. And bear with me here for a quick sec, because I want to emphasize something to your readers. Diversion is the key term here. And diversion refers to the taking of legitimate drugs intended for pain patients and selling them onto the street, either to users or dealers. And it doesn't take very many pharmacies to create a huge problem. That's the thing, one of the things we've found that people don't understand quite that well in this. If you have one pharmacy that is dedicating itself to selling pills to users and dealers, they can put millions on the street in a relatively short time, over a year or two. And we documented this on many, many occasions. So the user would come in. The word spreads like wildfire through the neighborhood and then far beyond into other states. And then the users would come in and they, for cash, would get, say, 30 or 60 with a prescription from a cooperating doctor, or 120 or 360. Each one of those pills is worth $30.
Wow.
So they may have plenty for themselves and then plenty more to sell. So what the DEA decided was, we're never going to be able to stop all this on the street by cracking down on the doctors and the pharmacies, though they tried. And so they moved up the chain to these gigantic wholesale distributors, companies that you and I have never heard of, McKesson, AmerisourceBergen, Cardinal Health. And these are the companies that distribute billions, with a B, of painkillers from the manufacturers down to the places that dispense them. What the law requires of them is that they keep track of these shipments, that they, when they see a suspicious one, that they contact the DEA, and that they hold back on those drugs. What's a suspicious order? Well, if a pharmacy is ordering 20,000 for its legit patients in May, and then in October it wants 500,000, that looks kind of funky. What the law did was it took away the DEA's best weapon for enforcing that law. So that is called an immediate suspension order. The DEA does its research. It warns you. It comes into the company and says, you guys are not reporting suspicious orders and you're sending too many drugs downstream. Company ignores the DEA. This happened on quite a few occasions. DEA says, that's it. We're locking up your controlled substances. Congress took that away. That was the weapon that the distributors feared the most, and Congress neutered it.
Why? And I know the answer is very complicated, but in a nutshell, why?
Right. The drug industry, with the cooperation of a small number of members of Congress, was able to push through a law that was misrepresented and sold to the rest of Congress as a way to get painkillers to legitimate patients. So the law passed both the House and the Senate on unanimous consent, which means there was never a vote on it, and it was signed by President Obama. And just as we described in the first part of your show about how a number of things came together to cause something very terrible, the same thing happened here. A few congressmen who received substantial campaign contributions carried the law, and then right at the end, when the DEA could have flagged it to President Obama or to senators who are now opposed to this, they kind of stood down. They made a political decision. A lot of the opponents were gone. And they made a political decision that they were just going to have to accept this or else things would be worse.
And the real, I guess, mover or shaker behind that was Pennsylvania Representative Tom Marino, who for a while was President Trump's nominee to be the drug czar. He has since withdrawn his name. He was interviewed earlier this week by Penn Live, and he's quoted as saying that he wrote the act after hearing from pharmacists in his district, which extended from the New York border into Perry County, that's western PA, that they could not get prescribed drugs for his patients. He's obviously saying he saw this as a more humane approach to making sure that people get access to the pain medication that they need. And Lenny, I'm just curious, does that square with your understanding?
No, it doesn't. I'd love for Congressman Marino to make these people available, and we'd be happy to interview them. There is no substantial evidence that on a large scale, the nation's 70, 75,000 pharmacies have had trouble getting pain pills, and that patients have had trouble getting pain pills. There is anecdotal evidence. We've all heard a story or two, but by and large, that is not the case.
How do you see this, Keith?
So I think Lenny's story and others like it illustrate how, in some ways, we've had a positive turn in the question of where these drugs come from and how they get to where they're going. It's moved from looking at individual bad actors to looking kind of way upstream, that there's a policy process sometimes that shows the influence of industry in policymaking with our elected representatives that in some ways sort of grease the path by which these drugs sort of move through the wholesale system down. And the DEA and other institutions like the Department of Justice under the previous administration had kind of gotten savvy about how to take on these problems. So you had the DEA in 2013 bringing suit against Walgreens. Sort of further down the chain, you might say, not the wholesalers, but the pharmacists themselves, for kind of looking the other way when it comes to, you know, restricting access to red flagged customers, consumers. And what you saw in the Obama administration is an attempt to kind of figure out the different ways in which large economic interests continued to drive the flow of these drugs to their markets once those markets had become established. And so this is once again why the politics of pain is – well, why pain is so political, because pain for a patient is a kind of a lived reality and they're trying to kind of get through the day. For a doctor, it's a question of commerce and also a question of compassion. But when you move further out into the commercial economy, this is major business. And these are enormous revenues. And many of these companies, they can actually tolerate the costs of paying a fine of $80 million in order to keep the economy going. And so this is the kinds of the economic interests that are sort of behind the curtain that explain how we've gotten into this problem. And I think Lenny's reporting and others have helped to kind of draw that curtain and allow us to see exactly what the nature of this problem is.
Lenny, I'm curious, how much did lobbyists for pharmaceutical companies, how much did they write this legislation?
We have an email that says in plain terms, it's one Justice Department official speaking to another Justice Department official. She names a drug industry lawyer, and she says flatly, he wrote the Marino bill. So we believe that in the early part, the 2014 or so, that this drug industry lawyer had a major hand in the first version of the bill. We do not have evidence like that as the bill goes on through its path. But we do know that the pharmaceutical industry was extremely interested in getting this law through. We don't have any way of tracking how often they met with Congress or who they spoke to or what they did. But we know they gave substantial campaign contributions to Marino, Senator Hatch, and other sponsors of this bill. And we know that they spent over $100 million lobbying on this bill and other matters.
Do we know I'm curious how much campaign contributions to Marino and others, Hatch and others?
Marino got about $100,000. Hatch got $177,000. I don't have the others off the top of my head, but they were in the tens of thousands for many of them. I believe the top person may have exceeded $200,000.
That's Lenny Bernstein. He's a health and medicine reporter for The Washington Post, co-author of this investigation. He's gotten a lot of play about how lobbyists for pharmaceutical companies worked with Congress to weaken the DEA's enforcement of opioid abuse. This was also a collaboration with 60 Minutes. Keith Whalew with us here in our Philadelphia studios, and he's a professor in the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Affairs and International Affairs, also the Department of History at Princeton University, and he wrote a book called Pain, A Political History. And you can join us. Any questions or comments, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play a clip from 60 Minutes. This is former DEA administrator. He's a whistleblower, Joe Ranasazi, and he's talking with 60 Minutes' Bill Whitaker about the role that large drug distribution companies play or are playing or have played in fueling the epidemic.
This is an industry that allowed millions and millions of drugs to go into bad pharmacies and doctor's offices that distributed them out to people who had no legitimate need for those drugs.
Who are these distributors?
The three largest distributors are Cardinal Health, McKesson, and AmerisourceBergen. They control probably 85 or 90% of the drugs going downstream.
You know the implication of what you're saying, that these big companies knew that they were pumping drugs into American communities that were killing people.
That's not an implication. That's a fact. That's exactly what they did.
Lenny, tell us about Joe Ranasazi.
Sure. Joe was, for about 10 years, the head of a tiny little backwater at DEA called the Office of Diversion Control, since elevated to a division, the Division of Diversion Control. And around 2006, it was Joe and a lawyer from the DEA named Lyndon Barber who said, let's go after these distributors. We can't control it at the street level. And they began a campaign to crack down on these companies who, as you might imagine, didn't like it very much at all. Lyndon is the fellow I referred to a little while ago who left the DEA and went over and now represents drug companies. For a while, he was at a private firm. Now he's a vice president at Cardinal Health, one of the big three distributors. But Joe and his agents continued this campaign until probably about 2013, and they were having quite a bit of success. There was even some statistics showing that when they went really hard into Florida, that they were able to bring the number of overdose deaths down substantially. And they were moving on into other distributors. We were able to document 13 distributors that they sanctioned, 16 cases total because some they hit twice. And they were having an enormous amount of success. In 2012, 2013, the companies began their pushback. And that is the process that we have been discussing so far.
And where is he today?
Well, in 2015, Congressman Marino asked the Inspector General to investigate Joe Ranasazi for, quote, attempting to intimidate the Congress of the United States.
Wow.
And I'm sorry, that was in 2014. This was based on an argument that Joe had on the telephone with some staffers. And we have researched this as thoroughly as we can. Joe has a temper. Joe did say in a rather heated exchange, look, you'll be protecting people who we have under active investigation, who are defendants in our investigations. As far as we can determine, that does not constitute an attempt to intimidate the United States Congress, but nor can we find any threats that he made otherwise. But Marino and Marsha Blackburn launched an investigation of Joe. That investigation essentially ended Joe's career. In 2015, he was forced into retirement. He now is consulting for some lawyers who are suing these very same companies, trying to recoup money for the cities and towns that have been affected by the epidemic.
Let me read an email. Keith, this is for you from Deborah in Syracuse. She's saying, I'm having a horrible time with the opioids conversation. Yes, it's a terrible thing for families to go through, but every time I hear it, I cringe. No one seemed to care when it was poor black folks. We put them in jail. Now that it's white folks, everyone is being trained to carry an EpiPen. I don't know. It's complicated. And obviously, it isn't just black folks and white folks. But I think I know what she's saying, that our response to crack cocaine was to lock everyone up. Mm-hmm. We're having a very different response to this opioid epidemic.
I mean, it's striking to see the level of both sympathy and concern for the victims of the opioid problem, in contrast to the three strikes and you're out. Even our drug policies with regard to marijuana and cocaine, as you mentioned, crack, in the 1980s, which was unforgiving. And so there, when to say that pain is political and to say that sort of how people medicate themselves is quickly politicized is to sort of illuminate these kinds of issues. The one thing I'd also say, you know, the problem is that the issues are not black and white, not just in terms of demographics, but the one sort of concern I sometimes have with the overstressing the concerns with Purdue Pharma and industry behavior is it doesn't acknowledge the reality of people living in pain, and that people living in pain are treated differently, and that if our response to the opioid epidemic is to restrict access through every available mechanism because we see the only driving force being bad industry practices, then a lot of physicians, especially those who work in palliative care, are concerned about what this means for people who live in pain, who depend on opioids, who aren't addicts in the sense that they're not at risk of dying, even though the risk is rising for many. And the other argument that I would say is that the fentanyl and heroin problem, cheaper alternatives, actually become more likely to be problems when you start to crack down on access to the OxyContins of this in this story. So,
and that's from the medicine cabinet to the street, essentially.
That's right. So there's a kind of a public policy complexity here, which is, yes, this is a problem of our own making. There are particular bad actors. One of the reasons why it's a problem of our own making is that it actually addresses issues in people's lives. And we have a problem in how we grapple. So one of the other features of this is that we have a system that pushes drugs as the solution to chronic pain more than it provides access to things like physical therapy. We have a reimbursement system that's so cost-conscious and cost-containment-oriented that Purdue Pharma and other companies have been able to make it clear that the drug is the best option given this economic calculus.
Rather than maybe a conversation therapy.
Exactly.
That's Keith Wailu joining us as well with Lenny Bernstein talking about the opioid epidemic. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Where do we go from here? This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with The Washington Post, Lenny Bernstein, and also Keith Wailu from Princeton University. And Keith, I'm looking at an article that you wrote, looks like April of 2016. The headline is "The Pain Gap, Why Doctors Offer Less Relief to Black Patients." Picking up on what we were talking about right before the break.
Yeah, I think that that's the other feature of the story. As we focus more on over-medication, it misses the point that there is a world of under-medication as well, and it's particularly evident in African-Americans and minority patients. There were studies done in the 1990s that show that if you were Latino in Los Angeles in the ER setting, you were much less likely to get access to analgesics. There are studies done that show those very pharmacies that are seen as kind of pushing oxycodone actually aren't stocking pain medicines in poor neighborhoods for fear of break-ins, et cetera. And there are studies in places like Atlanta that show similar kinds of lack of access for African-American patients to pain medicines, end-of-life cancer care. You see these disparities. So the trick is that even as we have a sort of a sector of this population that is overindulging, you might say, or being taught or encouraged to overindulge, you have this endemic problem of under-medication in communities of color. And last year, the article you mentioned in the Daily Beast was provoked by Proceedings in National Academy of Science study that came out of University of Virginia that basically surveyed medical students and residents and asked them whether black and white patients experience pain differently, whether their skins were thicker or thinner, whether their blood coagulated at different rates. And the striking amount of miseducation, completely unfounded by science. None of them make any sense. They have no basis in scientific, biological, or clinical thinking and reasoning. There are no scientific studies to support them. But it shows how these ideas about people's differences translate into their views about who experiences pain, how, and who deserves different kinds of relief. So for me, what's interesting is as the OxyContin story is emerging, recently, there's this very, really perverse statement that some people have made, which is, isn't it interesting that now that we know that African Americans were less likely to be medicated, maybe they were helped maybe this is a kind of a form of beneficial discrimination that African Americans,
because they're not addicted,
because
to
they're
opioids.
Not opioid, because they're less likely to be. So it shows you once again how you know, we see these pain questions through the lens of our views about race, our views about region, our views about difference, our views about the pharmaceutical industry. But the key point is that we have two problems existing at the same time. We have an over-medication problem and an under-medication problem, and we don't necessarily know how to handle that.
Would you agree with that, Lenny?
I agree with almost everything Keith just said, but I want to make this point. We can accomplish all of these things at the same time. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can take the CDC's word for it and other experts. No one wants to take away the 5 milligrams or 10 milligrams that an 85-year-old person takes for their arthritis that may mean the difference between getting out of a wheelchair and being able to walk around. That's totally fine with public health authorities, with doctors, with pharmacists. At the same time, however, there is also no need, when I take my kid in for a tooth pull, for us to go home with 30 or 45 Vicodin. Mm. And that can be curbed without having to take the medication away from the folks who need it. And also, we can also at the same time give people of color the medication that they need. There was a wonderful study out of Dartmouth where they went to surgeons who perform very common procedures, and they surveyed them, and they realized that they had absolutely no idea how many pills to send the people undergoing those surgeries home with. So they said to them, okay, gallbladder being taken out, give them 10. Appendix, give them 5. And when they went back and checked afterwards, these people had been sent home with less than half of what they typically would have been sent home with, and they took less than half of what they went home with.
Huh. And did they get the relief that they felt
they
needed?
Their pain, and they got their pain relief. And they got their pain relief. And so we can solve the over-medication problem without taking drugs away from legitimate patients.
And I would add that there's one other way to solve the over-medication problem, and that is to figure out ways to not emphasize drugs as the front line in the way that we deal with pain. Now, unfortunately, we have a system that has so sort of skewed away from reimbursement for things that cost money that the drugs fill this space. You know, back in the 1960s, when we had a robust pharmaceutical industry, we also had the emergence of multidisciplinary pain centers that employed everything from social work to psychology to surgery to pharmacology in treating chronic pain. Those things have largely disappeared in academic health centers because they simply cost too much to maintain. Wow. And the drugs have really filled the space. So, you know, unfortunately, we live in a society right now where cost containment still is dominating our health policy discussion. Nobody wants to pay more for really intransigent and difficult problems like chronic pain. And until we get past that, I think until we get past that, we're really not confronting the real problem of pain.
Let me read some comments from
and Marty.
Yeah, go ahead, Lenny.
Marty,
I do want to read some comments. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, sorry. And because insurance companies reimburse for medication, but they don't reimburse for those other procedures.
That's right.
Yeah. For those other therapies.
I hear you. Let me read an email from Kaylee from Princeton. We should shift our resources and focus on prevention and treatment. Our efforts would be much more effective. A tweet from Joni. What's up with the culture that generates so much addiction? We are a nation out of balance, seeking good and bad means to find comfort. An email from Mandy. Why is it so difficult to hold members of Congress and political officials accountable for accepting a large sum of cash in terms of the pharmaceutical industry, and going on and on from there? We did play a little clip from the president talking about essentially saying, I don't know how else to boil this down, but Nancy Reagan said, which is just say no. Lenny, as someone who covers health and medicine, is that an effective way to deal with this opioid crisis?
So the research shows us that just say no didn't work back in the 80s. And I would submit that just saying no when your doctor is trying to give you oxycodone for a knee injury or a low back pain is really not going to work in this case. And as we know, 80% of the people addicted to heroin right now started with prescription painkillers.
Right.
So I don't see that as a way to solve this crisis when the authority in the white coat is saying, take this.
And
I think the effort to reach out to doctors and tell them to prescribe less has shown some progress in the last 3 years or so. The number of prescriptions are down a bit, and I think that's the way we need to go.
So the other thing I would say is that the Nancy Reagan quote is from an era when the dominant drugs were street drugs, that is heroin, cocaine, crack, marijuana, LSD. Now, marijuana has become a medical substance, but in the period since then, what has happened is the rise of prescription drugs as the leading edge of our prescription of our drug addiction problem. I mean, that's happened in the last 20 years. So that now when we talk about drug problems in America, we're not talking about illicit drugs that find their way into youth culture, although that still exists. We're talking about prescription drugs. And as Lenny and others pointed out, the pathway by which they get to us are so much more complicated that just saying no is really not a reasonable way to address this problem. You have to address this problem because as a complex policy problem, because that's what it actually is. And I'd say the thing about Trump's quote at the very beginning, that we have to teach people not to start.
Yes.
It's just that is actually not that's not viable, because that is not, people don't just say, you know what, today I'm going to use some OxyContin.
The way
it starts is much more complicated.
We are also, and I should have probably raised this 45 minutes ago, but we are, Keith, in many ways talking about, if we're talking about pain, it's something that's very subjective. Probably your experience of pain is going to be different from mine, just because we're two different people here. Does that also complicate things?
It complicates things because it makes it difficult for physicians to figure out what when your degree of pain, how to judge it. It also is difficult in terms of figuring out what works for different people. For some people, a transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation belt, which sends electrical stimulants to your, let's say, back, works just fine. For other people, acupuncture works better. And so for some people, OxyContin works well and doesn't actually produce long-term problems. And for others, it becomes a problem. Right. For others, physical therapy is the way in. For others, the grin and bear it approach is the best solution. And so for others, I mean, we've entered the realm where medical marijuana is used to treat certain forms of pain. So we have a phenomenon called pain that is highly individualized. It's highly subjective. The degree of experts are willing awareness of how what your pain actually is.
Right.
We have a pain questionnaire, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10.
Exactly.
10 being the worst pain you've ever had. How would you rate your pain? But you rely on other people, the person with the experience, to tell you what their experience is. It opens up a realm where all of these debates flourish. Is your pain real? How should we treat it? Are we treating it incorrectly? Is the way we treat it producing another problem that then becomes a social concern? And so pain, in my book, has always been controversial, but partly because it's not the kind of health problem that doctors and society really knows how to grapple with.
Lenny, let me shift gears, and I'm just looking at a more recent story of yours, the headline meaning 44 state attorneys general want repeal of the law that curbed the DEA powers. These are 44 attorneys general essentially calling on Congress to, what, repeal the law that was changed in 2016?
Correct. Earlier this week, that bipartisan group, Republicans, Democrats, people from states hit the hardest, said to the leaders of Congress that taking the DEA's most formidable weapon away in the midst of this epidemic, which is supposed to kill 64,000 people in 2016 when we finally get all the data, is crazy. And you've got to repeal that law and give the DEA back that weapon. They need every weapon they can get right now.
And there's another feature of this, which is the state's attorneys general bringing lawsuit against Purdue Pharma and the drug industry because – and they're taking a kind of a strategy out of the playbook they used against the tobacco industry back in the 1990s. That is to say, at the state level, we have patients on Medicaid who are the victims, long-term victims of, let's say, smoking over the course of a lifetime. We're paying the cost, but your malfeasance in marketing or giving people a false sense of security that when they take this product that it's safe for them has produced this cost for us. And so what they're really beginning to do now in states like Washington and West Virginia is to begin to sort of not just go after the industry because of the deep pockets, but to connect the dots between the marketing, the increasing use, the toll of the drug in their communities, and the cost that they are carrying, and trying to sort of say, well, your profits should become part of the solution.
Mm, interesting. An email from Steve, I'm going to toss this to you, Lenny. He says, how does a bill get to unanimous consent without one congressman raising any questions? Can you answer that?
It's sort of remarkable, isn't it?
It is.
I was stunned. I don't cover Capitol Hill. I cover health and medicine. And so when I had to dive into all this, I was rather stunned by the whole thing that a bill could get through both houses and be signed by the president without anybody flagging this. But what you'll come to find out is that there's so much going on up there and so many people involved in so many different things that the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So what Congress depends upon, for example, is for the DEA to say, no, we don't want this. This can't happen. And that did happen in the House version of the bill. After it passed the House and was moving to the Senate, Attorney General Eric Holder held a news conference. No, I'm sorry. He put out a statement and he said, you know, this is a terrible bill. We can't let this through. Well, then there was some negotiation between Senator Hatch and the DEA, and it was watered down a little bit, but not very much. And the DEA made a political calculation that there were other battles coming on other days over other matters, and that they were not going to, stick something in the gears and get a senator to hold this up. And it went through Congress with literally no vote in either house.
Wow. Almost out of time here. I'll put the last question to you, Keith. And I think you've both done a fantastic job of laying out how complicated this is, some of the history. And I guess the question is, do you have confidence that we'll find that middle ground so the people that need pain prescriptions to deal with their situation can get that and we can prevent the amount of tragedy from the abuse of opioids?
I mean, I think every caregiver who is well-intentioned is constantly trying to find that middle ground in his or her practice every day. As a society, what I'd say is, unfortunately, we tend to kind of whiplash from one problem to the next. So in some eras, we think the problem is under medication, and others, we think it's over medication. Given the heated political nature of this right now, I'm not sure that this is the context when we as a society will find the middle ground. But I think it took 20 years to create this problem. I don't want to say it'll take 20 years to solve it, but I don't think it'll be solved next year.
We're going to end on that note. Keith Wailu, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
From Princeton and joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Lenny Bernstein, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
Health and medicine reporter for The Washington Post. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our newsletter, also listen to us on satellite radio. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.